All right.
Will you take your Bible and turn to Matthew chapter 5? Matthew chapter 5, and I want to say again a word of thanks. I exchanged messages with Brother George after last week, and he was so grateful for the way you welcomed him and expressed yourselves in your gladness that he was with us. And I do want to let you know that I'd like you to pray for George and his family. His wife did pass away, I believe it was on Friday. Haven't yet heard when services will be for her. Her name was Thelma, but you remember George and his family, and I know they would be very grateful for your prayers. Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to begin at verse 17. Our reading was to begin in verse 21, but because of our schedule, we didn't include that last week, so let's begin in verse 17. Don't assume that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For I assure you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until all things are accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches people to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commandments will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So you've heard it said that it was said to our ancestors, do not murder, and whoever murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. And whoever says to his brother, fool, will be subject to the Sanhedrin. And whoever says, you moron, or you idiot, will be subject to hellfire. So if you are offering your gift on the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, get that sequence. So if you are offering your gift on the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Reach a settlement quickly with your adversary while you're on the way with him, or your adversary will hand you over to the judge to the officer, and you will be thrown into prison. I assure you, you will never get out of there until you have paid the last penny. You've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery, but I tell you, everyone who looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife must give her a written notice of divorce. But I tell you, everyone who divorces his wife, except in the case of sexual immorality, causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you've heard that it was said to our ancestors, you must not break your oath, but you must keep your oaths to the Lord. But I tell you, don't take an oath at all, either by heaven, because it is God's throne, or by the earth, because it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, because it is the city of the great king. Neither should you swear by your head, because you cannot make a single hair white or black. But let your word yes be yes, and your no, no. Anything more than this is from the evil one. Everyone loves the Sermon on the Mount, at least part of it. Baptist News offered an article where Pastor Amy Butler, who pastors the Riverside Church in New York City, decided last week, after having written and prepared her sermon, first in this series on the Sermon on the Mount, decided to scrap what she had written to deliver and decided instead to deliver the Sermon on the Mount. All three chapters, 5, 6, and 7. She got up and she preached that Sermon on the Mount. Jesus' words, all of them. When it was over, they have coffee after the sermon. Probably the place where you can tell the pastor whether you like it or not. And some came and shared with Pastor Amy that they really had some problems with her sermon. You caught that? Let me back up. She preached the Sermon on the Mount, word for word, Jesus' words, all of them. And over coffee, some church members said, well, there's some bits of that sermon that I don't like. Okay, just making sure. I'm stunned by your response. I'm trying to muster where to go next. Here's what she wrote. She said, most of us really like certain parts of the Sermon on the Mount, the parts about the lilies of the field, and where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. But there are lots of other parts of the sermon, and frankly, many of them are quite onerous. There's the love your enemies part, direction about not being a hypocrite, hard words about divorce, a warning against religious leaders who smile too much. If you listen to the whole thing instead of picking and choosing the passages you like, I will guarantee you'll feel uncomfortable. She concludes, which is not something we in America like very much. We do to the Sermon on the Mount what Cornel West says is done to Martin Luther King Jr. And if you didn't pick it up last Sunday, George was with us, he reminded us that February is a Black History Month. If you watched the game last night, you saw the warm-up t-shirts. Black History Month on the players, both teams, as they warmed up prior to the game. And so what Cornel West says people have done with Martin Luther King Jr. is they've decided to take from him what they like. He calls it the Santa Clausification of Martin Luther King. What that simply means is you decide you want to take what you like. I mean, it's like asking Santa for what you want. You get from him the things you want, and then you don't have to deal with any other bits or parts. So, for example, what you will see in this month or on MLK Day, the day that honors or remembers his life, you'll hear and see on Facebook, social media, people will stand and declare, hate does not drive out hate, love does that. Or maybe you'll hear the opening lines, I have a dream that one day. But the part that we don't do or we don't pay attention to is that some who read all the way to the end of the I Have a Dream speech actually think that the speech probably is misnamed and should have been the Broken Promises speech. Just before Martin Luther King was killed, he had finished his last sermon. Wasn't delivered, but he had written it. The title, you ready? America May Be Going to Hell. Well, I'm pretty sure if what he had done up to that point hadn't got him shot, that probably would have. And I don't say that with any sort of whimsicalness about it. It was a very challenging call to the conditions that some people face in our world. But this is not a message about Martin Luther King Jr. But what it is to say that we do with the Sermon on the Mount, we do with the words of Jesus, the very thing that's done with the words of someone like Martin Luther. In fact, we do it with everybody. We find a key figure in church history, say Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and right now there are people scouring all of his words, and they're suggesting that in our day we are in a Bonhoeffer moment. No, we're not. Maybe there are some things that are there that are helpful to us. Maybe there's some things he said. But there are some who like to read Bonhoeffer for things they like from him, and then they kind of dispense with the rest. You hear folks quote C.S. Lewis. You like C.S. Lewis, Chronicles of Narnia? Folks love C.S. Lewis, and they'll quote C.S. Lewis, but there are lots of things they won't quote C.S. Lewis about. They won't quote C.S. Lewis when he has inferences that maybe God's grace is enough for everybody, all the time and for all time. We like to quote John R.W. Stott, that great preacher, English preacher who taught some of the best about how we engage culture. We love to quote John R.W. Stott up to the point where he says that he thinks that hell is not eternal, that people will actually suffer a bit, and then he sees annihilation as an option. We do this with everybody and everything. We find someone, I wonder what you say that, well, I haven't said anything profound, so never mind. But I wonder exactly if we understand that that's what we do. We always gravitate to the things that already confirm the things we think, the things we like. And so when it comes to the Sermon on the Mount, there are bits we like, and certainly there are bits that we are quite uncomfortable with. I was trying to think about how we can understand the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount, some people believe the Sermon on the Mount is so idealistic that it really is kind of this figurative aim, and one day this is what it will all be like, because we'll be finally changed and transformed, and we won't be battling our selfish impulses. We won't be inclined to disparage another person, dehumanize them, and cheat them out of being a full member of any particular society or culture. And so it's so idealistic. Then we say that maybe the Sermon on the Mount really is so idealistic because, boy, we're just mere humans. And then I'm left thinking that I guess we forget that Jesus was human, all too human, and still called us to live this particular way. And then it dawned on me, there's an illustration I think that works for how we might consider the Sermon on the Mount. This morning, this is, I think, the third time you've heard this song. We had it sung as a special one Sunday. We sang it last week, and then we sang it just a bit ago. The Cause of Christ. That's right. You're looking at me like you sang it, like I don't even know that song. And it's true. It's a new song. It's one that we're not terribly familiar with. And Rusty came to me this week, and he said, "Hey, I'm thinking about us singing that song again. It's a new one. Trying to get, you know, we try to do that to get people familiar with it." And I said, "Rusty, that's a hard song to sing. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. Its chord movements are, you know, I'm singing along over here, and I'm thinking the kids are probably hearing me, and last week especially, I'm singing along, and I'm thinking the next note ought to be a third up, and it goes the third down. I'm like, whoa, time out. So I listen again, and the music is lulling me to think that here is what you can expect. This is the next place to go with a note, and since I don't have a score for it, and I can't watch the little notes go up and down on the scale, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, it only makes sense that the next note is that note. And I'm the only one singing that note. Because that's not where it goes. And when you find us singing a new song, you feel that way about every note, don't you? Where is it going? And if you could imagine the Sermon on the Mount like a new melody to sing, you'd have to recognize that it requires us to take its full account and to sing it over and over and over again so that we become so familiar with it that it is not something new, but it's something that, well, it really changes the way we think about things. I thought, and Brad and I talked about it, and I thought about trying to get some classical music scores. If Zoy hadn't moved, he would have said, "Pastor, you made my day. You played some classical music." Zoe loved classical music. It's all I listened to. I think he probably listened to a little country and western too. But anyway, I think he mostly liked classical music. But I thought about trying to get a few scores that were familiar to you, like the theme from The Lone Ranger, or the sound of the score in the movie Jaws. Dun, 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 dun. You know, all those are classical. But what happens is that particular music evokes in you an anticipation of a thing. Dum, 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 dum. What's happening? You hear certain sounds and you immediately have a familiarity with what's next. You know how to respond. It could be one of those more kind of cautionary sort of sounds, and I'm not going to do all those musical kind of impersonations for you. But you could think about those where, you know, there's a kind of a sinister, sort of scary kind of move in the score of a movie, and you know something's coming. You can't see it yet, but you can hear the music, so you're already bracing yourself because you know what that means. The Sermon on the Mount ought to probably be for us considered much the same. That if you take Jesus' statement, you've heard it said, but I say to you, here's what he's saying. You're used to singing this song. You know the way all the notes go. You know what to expect. You've learned it from the time you were really young, from the time that your mom and your dad began to teach you how to sing the song of life. You've been singing this particular song. And you've learned from those in your peer group. You've learned at school from those of your classmates. You've learned it from your neighbors. You've watched what goes on in culture. You've seen it in the media. You've read all the stories, and it's always the same story. The melody of life is always playing the same notes. You've heard it said. And all those notes are prescribed in such a way to say, listen, you don't want to make any decisions that violate another human being, and all the emphasis is on your actions. And so you grow up with a good sense of legalism, not in a negative sense, but you grow up with a good sense of understanding that my actions are what determine people's understanding of what kind of person I am. And so you know that so long as I can look back and I didn't kill anyone, I didn't execute anyone, I'm all good. And one by one, you can read all those points at what Jesus said. You've heard it said. And you can go back to all those things that you learned as a child, as you learned as a young adult, as you learned as an older adult, and hopefully as you keep learning, what are all the things I can do, decisions I can make that can really make life really kind of go? And then all of a sudden, Jesus comes along and says, but I say to you, I got a new melody to play. It's not only about your actions. It's not strictly about did you do that thing or not. No, it's about what's going on inside you. What kind of person you are really is emanates from what's inwardly, what's in you. And so he says, you've heard it said that, and I say to you, and each time he points to a new melody, one that we're not familiar with, one that we don't sing often, one that we're just not sure. We need to hear it over and over and over again. Do you ever get tired of Nathan reading Galatians 5 during the repentance time? I know you're not going to admit to it. But when he gets up there and he starts in and he says, now you know from time to time I like to read this. And he starts, now the fruit of the Spirit are, I just have this feeling like some of us are going like, Nathan, how many times? One more. Every time is one more. And so when we come to the Sermon on the Mount, the reason that we need to spend time with it is precisely because we don't like the bits about it. And the bits that we don't like are the very ones that would form in us inwardly the kind of person that outwardly wouldn't need to be concerned with asking the question, did I ever kill anybody? You see, when we understand, when we grasp the realities that God's work in us by His Spirit is to form us to be a particular kind of person that isn't one who can say, I didn't do that, what happens is we become the kind of people that have no need for that. We have no need. So I thought, what are some creative ways to kind of take this section from verse 21 to 37 and say, What are some melodies that we have learned that we need to unlearn? Or what's the new melody that we need to hear in the Sermon on the Mount? What's the new way to think about life so that we have to unlearn, redo, relearn, or learn in a new way all the things that make us the sorts of people that really would be living in our world where the good is really the thing that is our goal and that good is a benefit for those who are around us? What would that be? So I thought, well, what if we decided that instead of singing the normal song of relational rancor, we sing a song of reconciliation? I alluded to the game last night. If you listen to it on the television, you wouldn't know there's a basketball game. All you'd know was that Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook weren't getting along. That is all you'd have known from the 30-minute pregame program to nearly every commentating moment from there till the end of the game, even when both those guys were on the bench. Everything was couched about the dynamic of these two who publicly did not and were not and are not getting along. And what I say to you is I think that is the normal melody we hear. We are so accustomed to people in conflict and not getting along that that's just the nature of things. And when we get at odds with somebody, that's just what we take up. Who's going to call who first? You see the signs? Call me. I mean, really. And that's what we do. And we learn from very young that if someone offends you, then they better come to you. And we learn that rancor is really kind of the best pattern and the best way of life, because after all, you got to protect your emotional self, you got to protect your ego, and you got to protect your position. So rancor becomes kind of the melody that we play. Or maybe anger would fit better. I just was trying to play with the R's. Because after all, what Jesus points us to is the necessity of reconciliation. That is the reality that if we are in a position where we're approaching the altar and we are reminded that our brother, sister, someone has something against us, we are to get up before we participate in worship and go and be reconciled to that person. So the new song, the new melody is reconciliation. That's the new thing. And boy, I tell you what. Don't you think we could get a dose of it in our country? Huh? I mean, the election's over. We're in 100 days, and I tell you what, they're still throwing out statistics that some of the most significant things that are causing problems in churches are politics. Now, you recall, I didn't tell you who to vote for, never going to do it. I'm not really prone to tell you what position you ought to take on this issue or that. It's not that I don't have opinion. It's not that I'm wishy-washy about it. It's just that really is not my game. My game right here is to say, okay, there's a new story. There's a better narrative. There's a better story. There's a better way to be in the world. And to be dependent on those things for your personal emotional satisfaction actually is an adventure in missing the point of life. So why is it we still have it? Well, because we don't know how to reconcile. We don't know how to reconcile the fact that there are people in this room who have different opinions on different social public issues. And it's like, no, we have to all see things the same way about those issues. Don't y'all know we're Baptists? And what do they say about us Baptists? Well, you get three or four together, you got four or five opinions. Right? And we laugh about it, but listen, you have a conversation long enough and that'll bear itself out pretty soon. So this whole idea of reconciliation, can you imagine what it would be like if there were a group of people committed to reconciliation in their relationships in our world? What would have happened if the notoriety for how you and I as God's people got along, and I'm not talking with each other, this is not, what do you call it, subtweeting today? This isn't some passive-aggressive pastoral move to say he knows of a grave conflict going on underneath the surface and he doesn't know how to surface it, so he's kind of used a sermon to get at you. Did that make sense? How about I say it this way? I'm not talking about you. I'm not saying I know of some unreconciled relationship in our church or between factions. I'm not talking about that. If I knew, I might. But what I'm saying is that what would it be if we were, our character was the sort of people that in all of our relationships we were bent on reconciliation, and that factored into our relationships that were outside of these walls, in our community, in our state, in our world. What sort of message, what sort of testimony, what sort of evidence would that be that there's a God who really is interested in how people get along in the world? So when we talk about reconciliation and being a new melody, we're not only talking about how's it working in your life, we're talking about how do we cultivate that practice and habit among ourselves. Go back and catch Nathan's last sermon, because he did a way better job on reconciliation than I'm going to do today on it, because that's not the sum total of what we're talking about. But what we're trying to do is use it as the illustration to say the Sermon on the Mount is to teach us a new melody for life. And what we're prone to do is we're prone to carry on the lessons we learn early that, well, just get mad about it. Just get angry about it. And the problem is that Jesus teaches us a new song. All those who we would count as our enemies, he says we're supposed to love them and pray for them. And what happens is that it kind of ties all of these together, starting in verse 21 and really, I think, really characterize what Jesus is teaching. He says that people should be treated as subjects, not objects. People should be treated as subjects, not objects. I'll give an illustration. I really am supportive of public educators, whether you're doing it at home or you're in a public school. But I think education is highly important, and I think we ought to support it. And I think there are movements. Now, I'm going to get political. I probably should preface that. I think there are movements in our country that will eventually treat students as objects, not as subjects. And the objects that they will become will be a means to make them a commodity so that someone can make lots of money. That's going on. And so when you take a student and you make a student a commodity simply as a figure that helps someone pad their bottom line to make extra money, you're no longer worried about what they learn and what kind of person they are. You want to make sure you got enough students so you can make a lot of money. You see how I did that? That's what I mean when we talk about treat people like subjects, not objects. Kind of the way it's most common is in our culture, women are objects more than they're subjects. Can you ever believe why you would sell a hamburger in a bikini washing a car? You remember that commercial from way years ago? I think that company's no longer in business, or they changed their name. Right? That makes absolutely no sense. Like, I've never gone and ordered a hamburger and someone came out in a bikini. Never happened. I know, guys, I look on your faces and you're so disappointed in that. But the point is in our culture, women have become the means to objectify, they've been objectified to sell products. You want to get worse than that? Our young people, youth. Youth culture has created of our children nothing but objects to which someone can sell something to. That is it. Started in the 60s. Jumped from Great Britain to the United States. They want to get at your money, mom and dad, so the way they get at your money is to get your kids. So your kids become objects in the economy so that you'll spend your money so they can pad their bottom lines for either themselves or their stockholders. So children become objects, not subjects. And so you will buy them everything that comes out so that they can occupy themselves, entertain themselves, sit them with an iPad or a television, put on a movie, and we don't have to talk to them, spend much time with them, learn that they have hurts and pains and they have fears and they have drama in their lives. No, they're objects. They're just... It runs up and down the scale. And if you think that women are now only objects, yes, men, we finally arrived. We're objects. What that simply means is people are not treated as human beings. They're treated less. And if you follow the progression in beginning in verse 27, when by the time you get to the idea where you call someone an idiot, says you're in danger of hellfire, That is moving to the place where you've ultimately determined a person is an object not worth loving and caring for. They're an object of scorn and hate. They're not a person anymore. They're not persons. That goes on in our world. And Jesus says we got to learn a new melody. So we got to treat people as subjects, not objects. And then we need to tell the truth rather than make up our own truth. I think that's pretty good, don't you? We got to tell the truth rather than make up our own truth. I know it's in that passage, let your yes be yes or your no, no. But it's really about truthfulness. It's about, listen, if you're going to say something, make it so. Truth. Now, there's a concept that's making the news. Who's got it? Whose truth is it? And this whole idea, I'm trying to figure out this post-truth thing. You got that figured out? If you have, let me know. I'm still trying to figure out, because post really means something beyond the truth. Well, I call that a lie. So I think post-truth is really trying to figure out how to live in a world full of lies. Is that new? Is that new? People have been lying to us since we were then been this little. It may have some sort of other cultural, social kind of implications, and I'm making a little bit fun of that, but it's serious. Truth is important. And so we ought to be truthful people. How in the world do you expect someone to believe us if we say really Jesus really makes a difference if people learn that we don't tell the truth? So I mean, like, when is it true? If we can't be trusted, and if our yes is wishy-washy, when it be true? So we have a truth. And when we get together and celebrate the Lord's Supper, we're pointing to a particular truth, a specific truth, a truth where we lay claim that God in Jesus is with us and that He died with us and for us. And we try to really wrestle with all the ways that that has implication. And I've got two books over 600 pages each, brand new ones out, talking about how we can talk about and understand all the implications for the death of Jesus. So if you think that it only means one thing, it has such breadth about and revolution for this new song we're singing that we really ought to be paying attention to all the ways that Jesus' death gives life. It's big. It's a big deal. It's a big thing. And so when we come to celebrate the Lord's Supper, we're tapping into that. And we talk about the fact that Jesus died for us. And there are lots of ways that we can talk about Jesus dying for us. But one of the ways that we don't want to miss is that we have to remember that when Jesus died, He died at the hands of people, human beings, who had been singing that old melody. Who were satisfied with rancor and anger and objectification, and they didn't care about the truth. And here comes Jesus saying, here's a new song, here's a new melody, and what'd they do? No, we like our songs. Sounds like the worship wars from 1980. Let me try that again. You remember when it was a big battle over the songs to sing in church. Lots of folks suffered on those debates. You think it's funny, but there are a lot of folks who just left church over things just like that. Because someone got angry, had rancor, decided to objectify those around them so that they didn't have to listen to the subjects that were important to them. Do I need to keep going? You see how it shows up in just even what we would say is some of the silliest arenas of life. But that melody that the world sings has been sung a long time. And Jesus died as a consequence of trying to say there's a new song. And if we keep singing that song, that old song, We're going to die. Keep singing that song that it's better to be mad and get your mad on and be angry. It's easier not to reconcile. You just keep singing that song. Treat people like they're objects. You just keep singing that song. You're going to die. It will happen. But take up a new song and they'll want to kill you. Take up a new song and they'll want to challenge you. Take up a new song. When Jesus came, he came saying, there's a new way, new life. And the consequence was that old song tried to extinguish him, put him out. But we look and go, wow, what happened in the resurrection? Now there's a melody, yes? Now there's a confirmation of a good song when it outlasts death. Yes? There's a confirmation that something is enduring, something you can count on, something that's true. So we celebrate the Lord's Supper, celebrate Jesus' death, that he died to deliver to us a new song. He died because you and I would have wanted him to keep singing the old song. You and I wanted him to keep singing it. We call that sin. When we decide that God's way isn't really the best way, it isn't the way. And Jesus died at the hands of those who wanted to sing an old song. But we're here to say that in Jesus' death, he put an end to all of that. And in his resurrection, he gives us hope and life. Man, I'd have thought in the Baptist church it would have been one amen. So when we celebrate, we like to think of what Paul says in Corinthians. Because he's really helping those early Christians kind of get their minds around all that this means. And so if you have a hard time getting your mind around all those implications, please know that so did those folks who were just not many years after Jesus' death, trying to get their mind around all of that. And so Paul wrote to say, you know what? We celebrate Jesus' death because he put to death all the obstacles to life. He put to death all the obstacles to life. So that's why Paul will say, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. In Jesus' death, God put an end to all the obstacles to life. So we take the bread and the cup, representing Jesus' body and blood, and we share in that fellowship. And we say, thank you for God's great big affirmation and yes to Jesus.